I find if it's a traditional orchestra, I prefer to fully embrace that and just try to have a clean break from the source material and not try to force it. For example, I've never been crazy about wheeling out a synth player on stage who looks through the presets on whatever keyboard to try to find a patch that sounds sort of similar to the thing from the game. And then it's going to be like the only element that's being purely put through house speakers. The rest of it is acoustic. So you end up with two different sound sources where there's an acoustic orchestra and then like a synth just sort of disembodiedly coming from somewhere. A lot of shows, they try to crack that. Never been super crazy about it. We're not doing that here. It's already kind of one step away from the traditional orchestra to have a drum kit and like amplified guitar and stuff. But that's well understood territory. And it's still very much about live performance too. So it'll work great. But yeah, those compromises are intrinsic to it. And all the things that kind of excite you about what you're doing in the studio might then have to fly out the window when you're doing it live.
Hello and welcome to Lightmap from Sifter, our video game industry interview show. I'm Gianni DiGiovanni. Today, award-winning composer of Journey, Abzu, and many, many more, Austin Wintory is here to talk about Indie Symphony 2, a video game concert happening next month. Before we jump into that, let's find out what's been making the headlines this week on Walkthrough, Sifter's weekly news podcast. Let's go.
Hi, I'm Kyle Paletto, and here are the top stories this week on Walkthrough, Sifter's weekly news podcast for Sunday, 15th of June. The showcase series continues. This time it was Xbox's turn with the new Asus Xbox Ally, plus remakes of Persona 4 and a new Call of Duty Black Ops. The US Actors Union SAG-AFTRA has reached a groundbreaking new agreement with developers, and people love hot girls fighting meaty monsters as Stellar Blade breaks records on Steam. You can get every episode of Walkthrough for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or on our website sifter.com.au every Sunday.
Join the Sifter community on Discord at sifter.com.au/discord.
There are a couple of names that are just synonymous with video game music. Koji Kondo from Nintendo, Nobuo Uematsu from Square. My next guest is someone who you would know the work of. And their name is also synonymous with video game soundtracks, but they're much more than that. Austin Wintory is the sort of composer that you'll see pop up all over the place, including in Melbourne, where he's working on Indie Symphony 2, a concert that's being played in Melbourne by Orchestra Victoria and collects some of your favorite gaming soundtracks. Austin, to kick us off, how did you all get involved and how did it all start with Indie Symphony?
So this is sort of a continuation, obviously, from the prior Indie Symphony show that we did. And my involvement in that was really owing to the fact that Orchestra Victoria and I had collaborated on Stray Gods when I needed to record an orchestra. The studio, Summer Falls, Melbourne-based, obviously collaborated, as we've discussed in the past, with Tripod and Montaigne. Similarly, Australian. They're all Melbourne. I think Montaigne is in Sydney. But bottom line is there was a deeply Australian vein running through that project. And so it made sense. In fact, there was support from Creative Victoria and other kind of arts grants type entities to say, you know, to try to incentivize us to record there. And I had done concerts with the MSO, Adelaide Symphony, Queensland Symphony. I have not personally been to Perth, but the WAZO, the Western Australia Symphony Orchestra in Perth, had played my music before. And it was very obvious there's an amazing talent pool in Australia. Like, the orchestral musicians in all of these cities are superb. Tasmania as well, and sort of by extension, of course, nearby in Auckland. It's just amazing how these, from an American perspective, this remote part of the world has such insane depths of talent. And obviously in all the arts, video games very much included, and it goes on and on from there, filmmaking, et cetera, et cetera. And so it was a total delight to work with the Orchestra Victoria musicians on the actual recordings of Stray Gods, an absolute highlight. We went, you know, drinking afterward together and just got along amazingly. And because they're also performance orchestra, they, of course, do the ballet and other concerts in parallel to the MSO. So we just stayed in touch. And when they reached out and said, we want to do this indie symphony concert a couple of years ago, of course, I helped them in a similar capacity to this one, where Elise from the orchestra sent me over her kind of wish list of music she'd like to perform. Graciously, some of mine was included, but also many of my wonderful colleagues. And the show seemed to come off great. I went down for it and was able to conduct my music as part of it and share the stage with, you know, with Tripod and the other conductor, Vanessa, who did fabulously. And it was awesome. It was so, I had such a blast. So I basically said to Elise, if you do another one of these, just assume I am happy to, if you want me, you know, it's a preemptive yes, in other words. And so to my delight, she called me again and said, hey, we're doing another one of these. And, you know, what else could we do of yours that you think could fit well? And then also, what do you think of these pieces? And I, both times I've been really impressed at her slash there. Like, I'm not sure how much she's speaking on behalf of like a hive mind of people brainstorming, or if this is all solely her brainchild. I don't actually know the answer to that, but whoever is generating these lists have great taste, because they're really, it's not an obvious show, but it's not this, it's not pretentious sort of deep cuts that, you know, require you to be this, you know, very sort of out in the fringes type player. Not that you couldn't make a great show from that, but obviously there's a certain amount of trying to sort of meet people where they statistically are likely to be. And these set lists do a remarkable job at that, I think, of saying, okay, what's, you know, what's a piece that everybody knows, and then what's one that, you know, probably some people will, but we can surprise them nonetheless. And it's a total delight. There's nowhere else doing anything like this. I've done a million video game concerts, but one that's so specifically built around indies and then cultivates this particular flavor of indie titles, it's really special.
You played Matchmaker with some of those composers involved. You were given that list and you kind of went through. And can you tell me a little bit more about the people you were able to convince to get on board?
One example was she asked about us doing the music for Slay the Spire. And that, so that the composer Clark, we didn't actually know each other. It was sort of peripheral awareness, but reached out and hit it off and said, you know, I'd love to bring you in and be involved. And the music from Undertale, this is one where I don't actually personally know Toby Fox. In fact, almost no one does. He's famously quite sort of reclusive. But a good friend of mine sort of administers the sort of music, the publishing, basically. A friend of mine is the guy that you go to if you want to perform Undertale in concert. And I said, they have this wish list of all these sections. It's never been done live, and certainly not with a big orchestra. So I said, as long as you can, you know, as long as we can have his blessings, we'll go turn this into a pretty gargantuan, you know, 15-minute suite of material. And he said, yeah, absolutely, go for it. And so I worked with my friend Brian, who's a phenomenal arranger, and we cooked up this. I mean, honestly, credit is 99% to him. I've mentored him a lot over the years, but I don't think I have anything left to teach him, because when he worked on this Undertale arrangement, he absolutely crushed it with essentially no input from me. I just looked through it and said, I have no notes. This is amazing. And it's a huge piece. I mean, it is a ton of material from that score. Jessica Curry's work, Everybody's Gone to the Rapture. I am constantly evangelizing for that score in particular and her work in general. I love a lot of her music. Dear Esther and Everybody's Gone to the Rapture are very special scores to me. I was very happy to see that be included. Hades 2, music I was, you know, personally involved in. It's principally the score of a friend of mine, Darren Korb, who's an actual staff in-house audio director for Supergiant Games and writes all the music in addition to doing all their sound design and all the rest of it. But he's not really an orchestra guy. He's much more of a rock band. You know, he's a drummer and a guitarist, and he sings and sort of a Johnny Greenwood rock producer type, you know, person. But for Hades too, you know, he said, we really would love to fold in a bunch of really gnarly big orchestral music. And, you know, so what if we wrote it together? So that was a blast. We did close to an hour of music together for the game. And so when this came up, you know, I said, it'd be really fun to feature some of that stuff because it really uses the orchestra aggressively, but it's also just some fun kind of rock tunes as well. So yeah, there's a little, you know, that's a taste of, I'm sure I'm drawing blanks on some of the others, or like last year, I remember we involved Lena Raine with Celeste, but that I started to say that and I was like, wait, no, that wasn't this time. That was last time.
Yeah. It starts to blur. I always love the look of when you have like a drum kit on stage with an orchestra and you have some of those other instruments that are starting to be involved that you might not see traditionally, like a guitarist on stage with an orchestra. Can you tell me a little bit about some of those elements that people will be able to see on stage with Orchestra Victoria at Indy Symphony?
I mean, there absolutely will be a drum kit and we will have guitar as well. There's more than one piece that requires it. So we'll have a little bit of, you know, for anybody that goes to, it's not uncommon in video game concerts, also like anime or, you know, like JRPG kind of shows. It's very classic. You know, you have to have your kind of wailing electric guitar. But there'll also be choir on this concert, which is a distinct difference from last time. You know, for example, we'll be doing Music of Mine from the game Abzu that, you know, leans heavily on a substantial choir. So it, you know, on the face of it, it will look like a traditional large orchestral concert. But of course, there's lots of little surprises. Part of the challenge with a concert like this, with any concert, is that frequently we write the original music that is being recorded and implemented to the game to leverage, you know, all manner of esoteric instruments or unusual kind of recording setups. And like, you know, case in point, Stray Gods, that doesn't use traditional orchestra. There's a fair bit of strings, which is what I recorded with Orchestra Victoria's musicians. But there's not like big brass sections and timpanis and things like that in general. And so when translating it to the stage, you want to fully take advantage of the orchestra that's there. You also don't have a bunch of the other instruments that we used, like in Abzu, for example, I had 7 harps in the original recording for that. Well, we have 1 because it's a normal orchestra. So I have to figure out ways to kind of only use 1, which involves obviously it's somewhere blurrily between rearranging the music and almost borderline rewriting it, because certain things you just have to kind of think of an alternate reality version of the piece that, you know, you make trade-offs. It can sound really good with this element, but we don't have that. So we have to find a way to not need it. That sort of thing. But that's the nature of doing live shows. And I love it. I do it all the time. I don't mind those compromises at all. It lets you kind of see the music through a new lens.
Do you find it a creative challenge, to use different instruments? I spoke to Jeff Van Dyke on the last episode of this show and talking about how, you know, when he's composing, he's sitting in front of his keyboard, but, you know, he has another instrument like a synthesizer next to him that he can just turn around and that just sets him into a different creative mode. And I'm curious about that sort of relationship you have with different instrumentation and different limitations.
Yeah, I mean, he's absolutely right that, you know, the instruments can be so inspiring in ways that, especially synthesizers, with the way they kind of are a bottomless well of possibilities. So much of live shows, I suppose I'm just sort of reiterating myself, but so much of that is frequently not available when doing live concerts, at least this kind of live concert. There are some that say, you know, we want to preserve as much as possible of the original sound. So we will use backing tracks and things where we can actually, you know, pull in the original sounds that you spent all that time crafting in your studio, and they can be coming back in speakers in parallel with the live orchestra. That can be great. I've done that before. I conducted a show a couple months ago in San Francisco where I wanted to do music from the Star Wars Outlaws games by my friend Will Roger. And he has all these cool kind of like hip hop type elements in the in the music.
Some trap beats sort of stuff in there.
Yeah, and like these 808s and stuff where I basically said, I don't want to even try to recreate that. Can you just send me the stem and we'll just rearrange the orchestra to fit our ensemble using those elements? And then, yes, it'll all be on a click with a backing track. And for that show, it worked out great. This indie symphony is a little bit more of a traditional concert. So we have to lean into the strengths of the symphony orchestra and we can augment it. But otherwise, yeah, I find that I find if it's a traditional orchestra, I prefer to fully embrace that and just try to have a clean break from the source material and not try to force it. For example, I've never been crazy about wheeling out a synth player on stage who looks through the presets on whatever keyboard to try to find a patch that sounds sort of similar to the thing from the game. And then it's going to be like the only element that's being purely put through house speakers. The rest of it is acoustic. So you end up with two different sound sources where there's an acoustic orchestra and then like a synth just sort of disembodiedly coming from somewhere. A lot of shows, they try to crack that. Never been super crazy about it. We're not doing that here. It's already kind of one step away from the traditional orchestra to have a drum kit and like amplified guitar and stuff. But that's well understood territory. And it's still very much about live performance too. So it'll work great. But yeah, those compromises are intrinsic to it. And all the things that kind of excite you about what you're doing in the studio might then have to fly out the window when you're doing it live.
You've just mentioned that you've been working on Hades 2 there. And I'm just curious what the last sort of, you know, I know some bits you might not be able to tell me, of course, but what the last year has looked like in work for you.
Yeah, I've been happily quite busy. I had a bunch of projects that were long in gestation that all kind of came out in rapid succession. So Hades 2 was sort of the beginning of that tidal wave where we worked on it last year and recorded it. And then they're still in early access. So the pieces that we did, the little chunks of score have been kind of dripping out. There's still technically some of our material together that haven't been released yet, but it's mostly out in the world at this point. I don't actually know how much longer their early access will go. That's above my pay grade with Supergiant. But that was the beginning of it. And then on the heels of that, earlier in the year, I did a game with a studio, a bunch of former Ubisoft people who started a new studio called Yellow Brick Games up in Canada, mostly in Montreal and Quebec City. That shipped their first title called Eternal Strands, which is sort of a fantasy RPG type game. The creative director, Mike Laidlaw, had been the creative director of the Dragon Age franchise. And so it's definitely one foot in that ground, but it has this whole other aspect to it involving real-time simulation of weather and temperature and stuff that lets you get really creative with magic and spell casting, because it's very much about manipulating the environment and not in a logic sort of Baldur's Gate sort of way where you go, I wonder if I apply this thing to that surface area. It's that literally you can start fires because, you know, the environment just reaches a temperature threshold where things start to burn and different things burn at different temperatures. And then you can start to experiment with that. And so similarly approach the score to say, how do we make something that feels sort of like in a way traditional fantasy, but also not. And it's sort of experimental in its way. So that came out in January. That was a total blast to work on. And then right on the heels of that was the release of a game called Monaco 2, which is the sequel to an indie game that I did 10 years ago, Monaco.
Yeah, like one of the very first wave of indie games. I remember Monaco coming out, and to see the sequel coming out now so many years later, it's kind of incredible, right?
Oh, it was so much fun. And the score is way more complicated and it's sort of ambitious than the first one. The first one was the narrow scope of the first one was its ambition. The original game was all solo piano in a very kind of silent movie theater style. And on this one, the kind of North Star was the idea of street performers and buskers being kind of a part of the narrative language of it, that there's always kind of guys playing street jazz, almost like you would find in New Orleans, you know, sort of not quite jazz, not quite folk music, sort of just jamming like a jam band. And how do we incorporate that into a score that has a very kind of almost ethereal and very slick modern kind of heist vibe to it? And so this fusion of of the busker and a kind of heist thing was sort of what formed our framing device for it. It was so much fun to do. Plus, I love working with Andy and Pocket Watch Games. We had done another game in the interim, their previous one called Tooth and Tail as well, which I loved, as sort of a love letter to 90s RTSs like Command and Conquer and Warcraft and whatnot. And I think it was Tooth and Tail is a masterpiece of a game. Absolutely love it to death. And so then, yeah, we basically went straight from that into Monaco 2 and just took forever to finish. And then right after that came out, just literally a few weeks later, was a game with a studio called Stoic that I've worked with on the franchise called The Banner Saga. Their newest game in collaboration with Xbox is called Towerborn, which is a total about face from The Banner Saga. Very happy and optimistic and sort of bright and childlike wonder game. But it's also this 2D side-scrolling sort of brawler in the vein of Streets of Rage. And we kept saying, you know, what if Miyazaki and Studio Ghibli wanted to make like an action movie? That what would the aesthetic of that be? And that became so much because it's all about the purity and the poeticism of Miyazaki in this otherwise very fun genre. And so that was an absolute blast. That had been done from my side for a little while. I actually recorded the orchestra for that very shortly after recording the orchestra for Hades 2 last year. So it was a very busy summer last year, our summer, your winter. It's been a kind of astounding, a bunch of things that either had been done for a while or were just sort of slowly gestating all in quick succession. Cause then next month is a game called Bitcraft that I worked on in collaboration with another composer named Rachel Hardy. That's sort of an interesting online sort of city building MMO, sort of an interesting quasi cozy game, but also has some really interesting system depth to it. And then after that will be Sword of the Sea, my latest collaboration with the Giant Squid, the folks that made Abzu and the Pathless, and he's the art director from Journey and Flower. Sword of the Sea, we're rounding the bend on. It's been a shockingly busy year, and it's actually rare. It's astounding that I can even talk about all those, I guess, because most of those are already out, but frequently, as you alluded to so often, it's, I really can't say what I got going on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a lot on my plate, but you know, I'm curious now if you would look back with, you know, years of decades under your belt now of those games that you first worked on. And do you have any sort of nostalgia or think about things of the work that you did at that time and sort of ideas that you kind of wished you had now that you would have loved at that moment?
It's always so tough to even sort of hypothetically imagine
or even
that.
Just give advice, I guess, potentially to give some tips on people who are in a similar position to you.
So much of the things that I did right by mistake. I didn't know I was making the right choice because you make tons of mistakes. Everything you do is just, it seems right at the time, right? You're not conscientiously being stupid, or at least hopefully not. And then you look back and go, wow, so that A, B, and C were inconsequential. D turned out to have been a really good idea, and E, F, and G were maybe not great ideas, and just thankfully they didn't shoot me in the foot. I think the thing that I've consistently done right, it doesn't always serve me, but when it served me, it served me very well, was that I tend to not struggle with being ambitious with projects. Like, in other words, I never have been able to look at something and go, yeah, this needs, you know, this kind of music where you can kind of hear it already in your head and you just sort of, you know what they're asking for. Try to just make sure that they get that and all's well that ends well. I've never really been able to do that. And so some projects, you know, I really, really pushed myself and I bled for it because I wanted to try to go somewhere I hadn't been. And on a game like, you know, my very first game, Flow, and then certainly thereafter on Journey and a bunch of games after that, that really served me well. I've also been fired off of projects where they were like, you know, you're just really kind of far outside of what we're looking for. And I think it's sort of taking too much work to find where that zone of convergence is. And you know, I look and I go, well, yeah, I mean, I did make a mistake in the very strictest sense of, you know, it's better to not be fired. But at the same time, I was in those instances when that's happened, I was true to myself. And I wasn't upset with them for wanting to part ways because I could feel it too. I could feel like this just isn't really clicking. For some reason, we're not seeing eye to eye. Whereas some projects like the Banner Saga was one where the music was, you know, reasonably experimental, especially for a fantasy game. But I got no pushback from the team. We were just in sync. So by some magic of the universe, my instincts aligned with theirs. It wasn't that I convinced them this was the right thing to do. They just sort of gelled with it. That's luck of the draw. That's not me being a genius. And that's not even them being great directors. That's just, we just like found each other and it's like a happy marriage. And that's a beautiful thing when that happens. So it's one of those where the advice that I often find myself giving to younger composers or people just starting out is I say, you know, you shouldn't be afraid to make divisive choices and do things that feel very you, knowing that not everyone's necessarily going to be on board, but it's so much better to be potentially a little polarizingly you than to be generic and nondescript. And all the times where I let fear creep in and I wrote something that started to get closer to being more generic, usually that problem takes care of itself because they go, this is not as good. Like, why, you know, this isn't working for us. Can you take another crack at it? Because I don't know if they think I'm phoning it in or if they just, it just isn't what they think they were supposed to get when they were hiring me. So they kind of catch me, save me from myself, I guess, in those moments. Or more often than not, I'm the one who's pushing too hard and they are, you know, they temper my instincts or we just part ways. So it's like, it's those times where it didn't work out were not pleasant. But I think the advice I would give my younger self is, you know, don't, you know, stay the course in those moments. You know, the only times you sort of regretted it were when you didn't stay the course, you know, even if it was a situation where you didn't get fired and there's just music out in the world that I privately am mildly embarrassed by. You know, I'm very lucky that that's rare because most of the time, like I said, I haven't struggled to be ambitious, and more often than not, that's the problem. You know, like there have been opportunities I've had, for example, to audition for projects where they ask me to write a demo, and I send something over, and they go, "This is so weird and not right for our project at all." And I was like, "Yeah, I mean, look, that's bound to happen. You're probably right. You shouldn't hire me for this, but in that one in a thousand shot that this weird approach worked for you, it would have been a match made in heaven straight out of the gate. I'd rather tilt that way. But you know, those moments, sometimes it's a really exciting opportunity. It doesn't work out because of that sort of a thing. And in the dark of the night, you ask yourself, is this actually a good strategy? Should I have been a little bit more easygoing? But I don't know. I just can't, you know, I get so bored of things where I feel like I've fundamentally heard this piece. Like, okay, technically not. Technically I wrote this, but what did I write? Everyone's heard this. These ingredients, you know, it sounds like every other, whatever, fill in the blank, action movie, Marvel movie, blah, blah, blah. So anytime I feel it tugging that way, I have a tendency to erase it all and start again.
It's going to be pretty exciting to have all of these incredible pieces of music played by an orchestra in Victoria. Do you think that you could take it on a world tour?
I wish. I mean, look, I feel very lucky that I have been able to travel decent chunks of the world because of this sort of stuff. And this, you know, in the last 10 years in particular, as game music has really started to enter much more of a kind of mainstream bit of public conscience, orchestras in particular are realizing this is a pretty marketable notion. And games are big enough and wide enough of a space that you can have a show that's, you know, all Final Fantasy or all... I have a conductor friend that does the official Elden Ring concert. It's just the one title. You know, Final Fantasy is a whole franchise of titles. Elden Ring is just the one game. They can sell out, you know, Royal Albert Hall in London with a show like that. And then meanwhile, we also have things like Indie Symphony with Orchestra Victoria. You know, and I love that there's room for all different formulas, and that, you know, there's no one right answer. I think it's absolutely, you know, thrilling. And so, yeah, I feel insanely lucky to have these opportunities and to have worked on games that people seem to have some interest in performing the music from. I don't take that for granted in the slightest. I mean, I got a lot of composer friends that write a lot of great music and they've never heard it done live before. I remember being shocked by that last time at the Indie. I did a Q&A with the audience before the concert and was sitting there with Christopher Larkin, who had done the music for Hollow Knight. And he made some comment about having, it's only been performed once ever before. He's never heard it done live or something like that. Something along those lines. I'm misquoting, but it was one of those where for a score of that level of popularity that it has, it was astounding to me that it had not been performed 100 times, you know, because Journey legitimately has been performed in concert around the world, I don't know, between 100 and 200 times in the last 10 years. I mean, all over Europe, all over the US, you know, Japan. It's crazy. It's surreal, honestly. And his music is equally deserving, if not more. You know what I mean? It's so beloved. And so I don't take for granted that I have these opportunities. I wish them upon all my colleagues in the space, because it's such a delight to come out of our little cave and be making music in a very traditional way with a live audience whose reaction you can really feel. And there's nothing like that. And it's a real privilege.
Austin, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you again. Let's talk again soon.
I am at your beck and call. Reach out anytime, and it's a delight. I love chatting with you.
Indie Symphony 2 will be performed by Orchestra Victoria on the 3rd of July and the 4th of July this year. It goes for about 2 hours or so with some incredible soundtracks from Darkest Dungeon and Undertale, Abzu, as we mentioned there, Hades 2 and Baldur's Gate 3 and many, many more. If you're interested, you can get tickets to that on the Orchestra Victoria website, which is orchestravictoria.com.au. Hey there, Gianni here on the latest episode of Drop Rate. We're bringing you another speedrun. This time we're digging into the prequel, Doom, the Dark Ages. You've got a shield, you've got a melee weapon, you've got the anger of all the previous games, but this Doom game has something a little bit different. In fact, something pretty different to all the Doom games you would have played before. That's right, it's got a story. You'll find out what happens to the history of the Night Sentinels. You'll find out about the demons of hell and the Khans and all of that wrapped up in a heavy metal cover of a video game. Is it as good as the previous games? What does it change? Well, you can find out more by listening to Drop Rate on your favorite podcast player, on Pocket Casts, on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, or you can head to our website, sifter.com.au, to read a full written review.
You're listening to Lightmap, interesting conversations with video game creators.
This has been Lightmap Sifter's interview podcast. Sifter is produced by myself, Kyle Paletto, Fiona Bartholomaeus, Courtney Smith, Kat Jahn, who's our social producer, Adam Christou, Chris Button, Mitch Lowe is senior producer who's edited this episode. Thank you, Mitch, for putting this one together. And my name is Gianni DiGiovanni. I'm Sifter's executive producer. If you are keen to see more of what Sifter does, can I recommend to you head to Sifter HQ on Instagram, on Blue Sky, or on Mastodon, whatever your favorite platform is. Just search for us at Sifter HQ. We post all our stories there. We've got lots of reviews for the Switch 2, other games coming out as well, other podcasts, many more for you to check out. Or, of course, just head to our website, sifter.com.au. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back with more very soon. But until then, have fun.
Ever wanted to hang out with a bunch of Sanrio characters like Hello Kitty, Kuromi, and Cinema Roll? Well, you can with Hello Kitty Island Adventure, available on Apple Arcade. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.